Hope Not On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Reinhold with Paul Steinhauser. On Background is presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association, representing the Granite State's long-term care facilities. Their mission is to see the state honor and support those who care for our most vulnerable citizens. We are going to discuss, as always, the First of the Nation presidential primary. A lot to discuss this week, as always, a steady flow of candidate activity here in the Granite State and on the show, as we both talk with Pete Buttigieg, as well as U.S. Senator Michael Bennett from Colorado. And first, though, let's take a little bit of stock right now as to where things are at in the New Hampshire primary, as Cory Booker, Kirsten Gillibrand in the Granite State last weekend, in addition to Buttigieg and Bennett. Paul, how do you see the primary right now? Bernie Sanders releasing his taxes, saying that he is, in fact, a millionaire. That taking place, that release of the taxes has not taken place as of yet, but will on Monday. Joe Biden, we're both reporting, is going to get into the race right after Easter. You had that first. gotta give you your credit. You're going to get a little upset.
It's all good.
And I think that, we are starting to see the race come to fruition, and we're also seeing more and more candidates get in. Now, Tim Ryan here in the Granite State as we speak. Eric Swalwell coming back to New Hampshire. And you kind of wonder, you know, what those candidates are seeing, and we're going to talk to them about this in regards to a rationale to get into a contest which is already filled with candidates.
Filled with candidates, and maybe that's one of the reasons why. It's such a crowded field. And you look at the last month and a half, you see a Beto O'Rourke, the former three-term congressman from Texas, surge as he jumped in. And now in the last couple of weeks, Pete Buttigieg, a nobody when he jumped in, right? The former mayor of South Bend, Indiana, surging as well. So I think some of these others say, well, if they
why
can
not
do
me?
Exactly, why not me? And you had, as you mentioned, just in the last couple of days, you had Swalwell, who was here last weekend before he announced. Then he goes on late night TV just earlier this week and makes his announcement on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. And last week you had Tim Ryan, no stranger at all to New Hampshire, somebody we've had on the show a number of times, announcing as well. He went on The View, daytime television, to do it. Are they long shots? Of course they are. But you know what? Why not me?
Yeah, Pete Buttigieg was the longest of long shots, mm-hmm. and then all of a sudden he had his moment, his narrative, the way he speaks met the time period, and then suddenly he was catapulted. You could see that for Ryan, because Ryan is a Midwestern guy. There is a strong constituency in the Democratic Party who feel that they need somebody from the Midwest to win the Midwest, to win the presidency. Swalwell, it looks like he is going to focus on gun control, just as Inslee is focused on climate change, hoping that being a candidate that is the strongest on a particular issue is going to catapult them to the front.
Yeah. I mean, heck, even Andrew Yang, right, the New York City entrepreneur, even he's caught a little lightning in the bottle, I guess you could say, in the last couple of weeks. So, again, why not?
I had a good friend who used to be in media. Asked me, he's like, so what's the deal with Andrew Yang? Like, I'm hearing a lot of my friends talk about him. I'm like, let me tell you about Andrew Yang. I mean, it's amazing. And you hear about Marianne Williamson. All of these candidates have, you know, a particular core constituency that they are hoping is going to bring them enough votes to make an impact here in the Granite State.
And get on the debate stage. That's the key. They need that oxygen. Remember, the first debate's coming
up
in late June.
That's a key point in getting into the race late. If you are a long shot candidate, that's a huge challenge. And so the window is closing on these folks to be able to secure the amount of fundraising dollars and donors and poll numbers to get into the first debate, which is in late June.
We'll hear a little later in the show, I spoke to Senator Michael Bennett of Colorado, who's going to get in a little later now than expected because of his prostate cancer diagnosis. And we talked about him being able to get on that debate stage, if not the first one in late June, then the second one in late July. It's an important factor. If you're not going to be on those debate stages, you're pretty much dead in the water, because debates have become increasingly influential in the primary process. We saw that really play out in the 12 cycle and again in the 16 cycle, that they're a lot more important now than they used to be in the years of old because, well, as much as we love New Hampshire and think we're the end all, the race for the White House has become much more nationalized over the last couple of decades, and those debates are more influential now than they were 20, 30 years ago.
Very often, you know, a candidate will come into New Hampshire with a particular mantra or prestige that didn't necessarily take place in the past, where the candidate is known. They have been seen on TV. They have friends that have talked about them from another state. The amount of communication that takes place is completely different. The days of Jimmy Carter being an unknown governor of Georgia, walking into bars and meeting folks for the first time and being able to win over voters that way is over. I mean, generally, if you are going to see a candidate speak, you are going to see them because you have heard of them, because you like something about them and want to learn more. The days of just, you know, everybody, because time is precious, of just going to see some random person speak is just not the case anymore. So, that, yeah, there's a big difference in that, the candidates are known to people before they come to the Granite State. We've seen some poll numbers about Biden and whether or not there is an impact from the week of coverage and his campaign or campaign in waiting's handling of the allegations of him making women feel uncomfortable in various circumstances by being overly affectionate, hugging and such. Is there any, in your view, substantive effect that is having on Biden at this point?
Well, the poll that came out that we're talking about is from Politico and Morning Consult, the national poll. That indicates that no, the majority, 50% of the Democratic voters questioned in the survey indicated that the controversy, the crisis, whatever you want to call it, will have no bearing on how they view the vice president and who they pick for their party's nominee. About 25%, a quarter said that it might make them more unlikely to vote for the vice president. 14% said it might make them more likely. It seems that for now, at least, the vice president has escaped from this controversy relatively unscathed. He's taken some dings, obviously, but it's not something that's sinking his campaign to be.
Let's talk about Bernie being a millionaire. And, I suspected, and we'll see more when the taxes are released, but I suspected the biggest reason that Bernie was holding out pushing forth his tax returns, and he had said initially that he was going to release them soon, I believe over 40 days ago, and I had a feeling that it was because he was pretty wealthy, and he has amassed a significant amount of wealth, and in fact, it was over seven figures. That appears to be the case from what he said in an interview with CBS. Does that hurt Bernie at all, or can Bernie do whatever Bernie wants with Bernie's supporters, or do they look at him and say, wait, he's a millionaire? He's part of the problem and not part of the solution.
Yeah, but where did he get his money? I mean, it's from book sales. And Elizabeth Warren just filed her taxes, today as we record this, and her and her husband had an income of $900,000 last year, $350,000 again from book sales. So I think some conservatives will try to ping both Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, since they're the populists and they're the champions of the working class in this race for the White House. I think they'll try to ping them on this. I don't think it has much legs. What has been troublesome for Bernie Sanders has been his resistance to release these tax returns. Remember, he didn't do it when he ran in 2016, and he's been kind of delaying the response here. There's been a lot of calls for him to release those taxes. In fact, with Warren, as we recorded this on a Wednesday, releasing her taxes, she put out a statement urging everybody to do it. That was a jab at Bernie Sanders, also a jab, of course, at Donald Trump.
Right. And I think that it's a situation with Bernie and Elizabeth Warren where, when you think of populists, when you think of individuals who are leading a revolt, the way that a revolution, the way they're trying to lead it, you generally think of working class individuals, the scrappy Robin Hood type individual who is the person who is doing it, who has risen, and these individuals are extremely wealthy. But if it were the flip side and the person was, carrying heavy debt and was, not successful, they'd be criticized for that as well. So I think that individuals, for the most part, want a presidential candidate and contender that has found stable footing and has been successful in their finances. So I don't necessarily think that this is going to hurt either one of them. If you know they were individuals who had enriched themselves, and again, this is an aspect which we'll find out, mm-hmm. but if they've enriched themselves, in Bernie's case or others, off of Wall Street or off of the stock investments that are of the same companies and entities that he rails against, that's something different. So that's, again, the significance and the story here is what you learn about an individual via their tax returns and whether their rhetoric matches their actual living. And that, again, is what we've been asking for and wanted to see in regards to Donald Trump's tax returns for many years.
Yeah, now the House, under Democratic control, is trying to get those taxes released, demanding that the White House, have the IRS send them over. The president again pushing back. So that fight continues, but expect to see by next week, with the tax reporting day on the 15th coming up in just a few days, expect the remaining candidates who haven't put theirs out to put theirs out.
This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Reinhold with Paul Steinhauser. When we return, both of us talked with Pete Buttigieg, the upstart candidate from South Bend, Indiana, who had big crowds here in the Granite State this past weekend. Back with more after this on Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. Welcome back. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Reinhold with Paul Steinhauser. Pete Buttigieg was in the Granite State this past weekend for two public events, one at the Currier Art Museum, which had to be moved from a brewery in downtown Manchester to the Currier because of the interest in seeing Buttigieg. And even that didn't have enough capacity for all the folks that wanted to see him, as he had an overflow audience as well. There were a couple hundred people in Gibson's bookstore to see him as well on Saturday. And what you sensed and got was that this was a campaign that really has it going on right now.
Yeah, that's the narrative you want right now, right? That you need bigger venues because you have larger crowds than expected. So everything's going right now for Pete Buttigieg. The question is, though, going forward, can he maintain that momentum? I had a chance to chat with him as he arrived in New Hampshire, and we talked about that and about that $7 million that he reported, that campaign cash haul, and how he's going to spend that money and whether he's going to be beefing up, staffing up in the early voting states. Take a listen. All right. Last time we chatted was before your campaign cash numbers came out, and you were, hoping that with a big report, you'd be able to start expanding campaign staff. And I'm wondering specifically here in New Hampshire, are we going to see, people on the ground soon? I know you've been relying on volunteers your last couple trips here.
Yeah, no, we got a great team coming together. We're not quite ready to roll them out, but obviously you're only as good as your people, and we're really excited about the folks we're going to organize for this. So, we've now reached a level where we're kind of past the initial stages of introducing ourselves, and while we need to continue introducing ourselves across the state, we're now beginning to think more about organizing and building a ground game that'll make it possible for us to really engage people and make the most of the grassroots energy we have. So in the initial stages, we're simply asking people to help spread the word, and of course the finance piece, but over time we need to build the capacity to put a clipboard in somebody's hands and really engage people at the door-to-door level.
So I know you've doubled the staff back in South Bend from 20 to 40, and you're now in the newer, larger headquarters, but you do envision putting boots on the ground in the early states in the next weeks?
Yeah, absolutely. We're intent on continuing to have a lean and scrappy operation, but there's no way that you can do this well without boots on the ground.
Gotcha. Today, Vice President Joe Biden in Washington, D.C., in front of a very friendly crowd, joking a little bit about the controversy that he's been dealing with. Later, he was a little more somber when talking to reporters. But do you think for the vice president, that's maybe the right approach right now?
I'll leave that to the vice president. I think all of us in this process need to really think about how our actions and our words affect other people. And I think everybody you know, the political space right now is being held to a higher standard than historically on this. And I think that's a healthy thing that compels all of us to make sure we're doing the right thing. And it's not bad that there's a higher level of expectation and accountability right now.
Do you find what he said, or not what he said, I'm sorry, his actions over the years, do you find that disqualifying for him? Should he not run for the White House?
You know, again, I don't think it's my place to say whether any other person should or shouldn't run. I do think it's important that he's been addressing it, and I'll leave the rest to him.
You were in New York City talking to Al Sharpton and the National Action Network on reparations. I know you said you would support the Sheila Jackson leave bill right now, which would call for a study committee. I'm wondering, though, would you go further? As a president, would you support financial reparations?
Well, that's the point of the study committee. I think this has been caricatured as a proposal for a kind of check in the mail. I think what we're really needing to explore is how do we take situations where right now we know somebody is at a specific, sometimes measurable disadvantage because of deliberate racist policies, and find some way to try to put that right. And I don't think you can do that without financial commitment, but that may work through policy instruments, making sure that we're targeting housing support to neighborhoods that have been victims of redlining, or making sure that we are directing support for educational resources to areas or neighborhoods or families or schools that have been excluded systematically. There are any number of ways that this can take shape, but the reason this needs to be studied rigorously is so that we can assess what could be developed that most Americans could agree is fair, that would also make a difference on inequities that we know are being experienced by millions of Americans today as a consequence of deliberate racist policies, either in the past and sometimes in the not very recent past, and some structural racism we're living with even in the present.
I've got a front page article in one of the local newspapers today talking about how you're coming back here to New Hampshire in a very different situation compared to where you were last time you were here about a month ago. Are you concerned, though? I mean, it's great. The media attention, everything, the money, the big crowds. You needed a larger venue for tonight. Are you worried, though, that you maybe, you know, is there any concern that you're peaking too soon, that this is coming too early in the process? We have 10 more months to go till the votes start.
Yeah, I think anytime I think that I might be, you know, I'll give you an example. I was in the airport on the way to come up here and standing in line to board the flight to Manchester, and three or four people came up to me to say something nice or wish me well, and the lady standing next to me turned and asked what I was traveling for, and I explained that it was because of the election, and then she asked which network I was a reporter for. So, you know, anytime you think that you're overexposed, something will put you in your place. We still got a long way to go before I'm a household name, let alone before we can say we've consolidated our support. It's heady and it's exciting seeing this kind of attention, but I'm under no illusion that that we're even a fraction of the way toward getting known and getting our message out. And while it's amusing to think that people are asking whether I'm peaking too soon, given where I was a month ago, you know, we're very mindful that these are the early stages, and there's a lot of unglamorous blocking and tackling and quantity time ahead in order to really make sure that we have a strong position.
You raised $7 million in the first quarter. What's your goal now for the second quarter?
Yeah, I'm not ready to float a number on that, but obviously we're thrilled with the pace. We've been working to pick up the pace of fundraising, and we'll need to do that in order to make sure that we can finance a strong organization. We're not necessarily going to have the same dollar totals as the most globally famous people in the race, but that's okay. What we need is the ability to demonstrate that we can gather resources, and most importantly, to finance these operations, whether it's boots on the ground here in New Hampshire or a strong headquarters back in South Bend.
That's Pete Buttigieg with Paul Steinhauser. I also talked with him after the Gibson's event briefly, and there's three aspects of Buttigieg's candidacy which are really intriguing to me. One is that he is battling for Christianity and trying to create a Christian left. And for a long period of time, Democrats have kind of ceded Christianity and, you know, talking about Christianity to conservatives and to Republicans. He is talking openly about Christianity and his faith. So there's that. There's also the fight for Springsteen voters, individuals that are in rural towns who have seen their communities and their economic well-being changed by large-scale economic policies. He's speaking to them. And the third is the fight for the American flag, which has, in the view of many, become kind of a Republican symbol as opposed to a Democratic or American symbol. And I talked to them about those three things.
Great to be joined by Pete Buttigieg here in Concord. And really interested in your candidacy for a couple particular reasons. You're talking differently than other Democrats have in the past and political figures, particularly in two issues, Christianity and also economic opportunity. What do you see as being the need on your part to take back Christianity from the right? And is it important for Democrats to talk to voters that perhaps they haven't talked to in the past?
I think it's wrong to assume that the only way a religious person can vote is with the right. God does not belong to a political party. Now, I believe in the separation of church and state and that politicians need to represent people of any faith and of no faith. But I can tell you that my faith points me in a direction of being involved in a progressive way, lifting up the least among us, being there for the prisoner and the stranger and the immigrant and the poor. And to me, that has very real political implications. I don't think we should be afraid to talk about where we believe Scripture points us if we think that harmonizes with a broader progressive message.
Springsteen voters, group of individuals that Trump did very well with in the last election, individuals who care about economic opportunity, jobs returning to small towns in rural America. How do you go about not just reaching them, but creating an economic message that brings them success and prosperity?
First of all, we got to acknowledge that people in industrial communities like mine have been let down by Democratic and Republican presidents for decades. But that's precisely why we need leadership now that is focused on lifting wages, on making sure people have good benefits, health care, the ability to organize, all of the things that helped us build a strong middle class. And I just refuse to believe that the only way to reach the middle class or the Midwest is through a prism of resentment. I think that people in industrial communities like mine are hopeful. They want to look to the future. They just need to know that somebody in that political process is standing up for them.
The other thing is the fight for the American flag, so to speak, in that the Republican Party uses the American flag, as we saw with President Trump in the NFL and so forth. Do you feel that there needs to be a push by your candidacy and others to reclaim the American flag, which has become kind of a Republican symbol as opposed to an American symbol, and create an element where individuals are believing in that regardless of political affiliation?
Yeah, the whole point of the American flag is it belongs to all of us. It doesn't belong to one political party. And when I went into a war zone with that American flag velcroed to the shoulder of my uniform in Afghanistan, I knew that I was there to serve everybody. And we should not treat that. It diminishes America and it diminishes the flag to treat it like it's the property of one political party. I believe that my party actually has better answers on national security than our competition right now. We just shouldn't be afraid to go out there and explain it.
Mayor Pete, great to see you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Reinhold with Paul Steinhauser. We return an individual who is looking at running for president while also battling prostate cancer, Michael Bennett, U.S. Senator from Colorado, after this. Welcome back. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Reinhold with Paul Steinhauser. Michael Bennett became an individual that rose to fame in some circles due to a speech on the Senate floor in which he went after Ted Cruz during the shutdown over the funding for the border wall. And he went after Cruz's support for that and also a previous shutdown. And he had kind of this, you know, angry as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore type of persona, like a Mr. Smith goes to Washington and is yelling and getting upset, and but also in a very kind of intellectual type of way, which you see very often from senators. And he recently disclosed that he has been diagnosed with prostate cancer.
Yeah, it was interesting. And he made light of that incident with Ted Cruz because he's known as a mild-mannered politician. So that was a little out of character for him. He was here, as you mentioned. He spoke to both of us. I had a chance to chat with him in Exeter, New Hampshire, after he did a meet and greet with the Rockingham County Democrats. And we started with that news about his prostate diagnosis.
Since we talked last time, obviously, the diagnosis on the prostate's come up. I was curious, today, you didn't bring it up. Somebody wished you well with your recovery. But is it something you're not discussing a lot on the campaign trail?
Well, I don't feel the need to bring it up myself. I mean, I'm obviously glad to talk about it if people want to raise it. But in the last meeting, nobody raised it. But at the end, everybody came up and said, "Oh, I hope you're going to be okay." And I said the same thing. I mean, I feel really lucky because it was caught early, and this is a highly treatable form of cancer, and we have insurance. So I think I'm going to be fine. And I hope I will, because I really want to have the opportunity to run in 2020. So we'll see.
The game plan originally was an April announcement. The procedure's this week or next week?
Yeah, it's the beginning of the recess, which is coming up.
And if you get the clean bill of health, then you're looking like for a May or a June launch?
Well, I think it's got to be sooner than that. If my health won't allow me to do that, I think that's pushing the calendar a little bit. And I think I'm okay now, and if it runs a few weeks, I think that's fine. But at some point, it could be late enough that it makes it hard to do. So, but I don't think that will happen.
I was going to ask you, this is running for president is a nonstop, grueling thing,
right?
And somebody recovering from cancer. But then I went back and I remembered that John Kerry was in a very similar situation.
Right.
Yeah, and he ended up winning the nomination at almost the White House. So, you're up for this, obviously, physically.
Oh, definitely. And John was 59 when he had the same operation. He had it, and 2 weeks later, he was in California doing what he needed to do out there to campaign. So, look, I take this seriously, but I think that if all goes well, I don't see this stopping me. And I was skiing the weekend before. Two weeks ago, I was skiing with my kid and my wife in Colorado, and I felt just fine. And I won't be skiing for the next few weeks, but I think I can campaign after that.
Is there a concern, with so many people in the race, we're almost up to 20, it's crucial, if you want to stand out, to get on that debate stage. First debate's in June. You're getting in late now. Are you going to be able to make that stage?
Well, we've made it a little harder on myself, although I wouldn't have asked for this issue. I think it's important to be on the debate stage, whether it's the first debate or the second debate or however you're able to do it. And we will work to try to get on there. I don't want to make excuses for it, but we are slowed down a little bit. And we're going to have to, I've got confidence in my team figuring out how we can manage to do it.
I also talked with Bennett down in Nashua.
So we're joined by U.S. Senator Michael Bennett from Colorado here at Jaja Bells on the campaign trail in Nashua on the program today. And first off, talk about what is driving your decision here and what is driving you to want to pursue the presidency.
Well, everything that I've done in my life has been about trying to create more opportunity for the next generation, whether I've been in business or running the Denver Public Schools as a superintendent. And I think this is just a critical moment in our country's history. I think it's really important for people to level with the American people about the challenges that we face, which are considerable, the issues in our economy and in our democracy that we have to overcome if we're going to continue to honor the legacy of our parents and grandparents and preserve this exercise in self-government for another generation and drive economic growth for everybody in the country. And as I've seen the race go, I've felt like I'm not hearing that necessarily out of other candidates, and I think there's a real opportunity to contribute, and that's what I want to do.
When you look at Buttigieg and Beto, two individuals have drawn a tremendous amount of attention and have come, one is the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, was the longest of long shots coming into this race, and Beto obviously was kind of a phenomena. Do you look at that and get disappointed that individuals that don't have the substance and the amount of time spent in public service are rising to the forefront, or do you look at that and say anybody at this point can have a moment where they rise?
I look at it and say anybody can have a moment, and I look at it and say to myself, Somebody's going to need to earn this nomination. You know, I think Democrats are going to want to know that the person they nominate can take on Donald Trump, and it's going to be hard. There are a lot of people in the race, and we're going to see ups and downs. It's not going to be easy. It's not going to be given to anybody. And when I see somebody like Mayor Pete, whom I like, I know him well. I don't know Beto. I've met him a couple of times and have been interested by other people about what that phenomenon is all about. But with Mayor Pete, I know him. He's a guy that has a point of view. You know, he's been a mayor. He's done hard work. He's been a veteran. And he knows what he thinks. And to see people responding to that is actually quite gratifying to me, because I feel like I've got a point of view. I know what I think. I may not be one of the best known people in the race. In fact, I know I'm certainly not one of the best known people in the race. But I think people's minds are wide open, and that creates a lot of interesting opportunity.
So the policy side is what's driving you the most, in that there's, you don't feel that there's enough, particularly in education, which you talked about here, there's enough conversation in regards to that, and if you do not have success, you want to be able to change the dialogue?
Well, I would say, first of all, I hope to have success, because I wouldn't want to do it if I didn't have it. If I didn't think I had a chance to win, I wouldn't run. There are other things that I could do. I think there is a chance that I could win. And if I did, what I'd be focused on is what I talked about here, not just education, but the fact that for the last 40 years we've seen stagnant incomes for 90% of Americans, and I've got ideas about what we could do to change the child tax credit and the earned income tax credit to really increase the take-home pay of people, not just annually, but on a monthly basis, that really would be a great, not only great benefit to working people in the country, but a shock in the arm to the economy generally. I guess on the point of, you know, if I lost, my daughter said to me once, "Dad, if you ran and you tell the truth and you lose, nobody can fault you for it." And I said to her, "You know what, Caroline? That's good, because the way I think about this is there's no other way for me to win but to tell the truth. There's no other reason for me to be in the race." You know,
one of the driving questions that a lot of Democratic activists have here is which of these candidates can defeat Donald Trump, and that seems to be kind of the first and foremost in regards to their mindset. This is a very policy-oriented race so far, but that's at the forefront. In your view, how do you go about doing that? What about your skill set would allow you to have success against him, and how do you go about engaging or not engaging with Donald Trump?
I think that, as I said earlier, I think that is the number one threshold question that people are going to decide this election on, the whole nominating process, but certainly here in New Hampshire, I think in Iowa as well, and the other early states. I think what I have to offer in that regard is that I have deep policy knowledge. I've thought about this stuff a long time, and I don't think Donald Trump is going to get away with the kind of lies that he's told if somebody like me is on the debate stage with him. You know, he intimidates people that are in his orbit, and I don't feel intimidated by him. I feel outraged by the extent to which he lies to the American people and covers stuff up. Healthcare is the latest great example. It's not the only example. But here's a guy who ran saying, now the first step, by the way, of beating him is reminding people what he said when he ran. It's not a blank slate. He said, in saying we should repeal Obamacare and all that stuff, "I'm going to give you this beautiful healthcare system. You're going to love this healthcare system. It's going to be so cheap. It's going to cover everybody. It's going to be easy." And now, 2 years into his presidency, all he's done is try to take insurance away from 20 million people and take it away from people who have pre-existing conditions. And now, 1 week, he says, "I'm going to deliver for you now." The next week, he says, "It'll be after I get reelected." I mean, this is the kind of stuff where he has to be held to account for what he said. And the American people need to understand that he's lied to them over and over and over again, and we can't accept that in our president. You know, I realize, look, I've worked there for 10 years. I know how messed up the place is. It's a disgrace in many ways. But the fact that it is a disgrace can't repel us. It has to be an invitation for us to make it better, to improve it. I just, you know, as the father of three kids, can't accept the idea that this country's political system is going to, that we're going to accept that it's damaged in the way that it is forever. I mean, your political system's not damaged this way in New Hampshire. Our political system in Colorado is not. The school district, the city and county that I worked in is not. Yet we've allowed Washington to get overcome by a set of forces that are mostly interested in preserving the status quo for the, you know, the wealthiest interests in the country and not doing what's right for the American people. We can't treat that as a foregone conclusion, I guess, is my point, you know?
Yeah, a couple things off of that. First, your speech that you gave during the shutdown in which you called out Senator Cruz is one of the best floor speeches I've seen because of the depth of knowledge and the passion that you exhibited during that, throwing in facts such as the Denver airport being the last airport to be modernized in the country, but that was 25 years ago. Is that the type of candidacy that you would have? Do you, a strong and vigorous and angry, fact-filled type of?
People asked me. They said, "Was that speech spontaneous?" And it was spontaneous in the sense that I went out to the floor expecting to vote and to go somewhere else. I wasn't expecting to go after Ted Cruz. And in fact, there were two other Republicans that made the same point that he made, and I didn't go after them. But I went after him because my state was flooded when he shut the government down. I know what he cost my state. But in my mind, I'd spent the last 2 years writing a book about what that speech is about. That's what my book is about. So in that sense, it wasn't spontaneous, but it is what this campaign would be about. Take another example, by the way, that I didn't use in the speech, but I've been thinking about recently. We've just consumed at least 4 months, maybe 5 months, of the American people's time over this foolishness of the rinky-dink wall and the $6 billion, while China has, you know, in 3 years has used more concrete than we used in the entire 20th century. I think it's actually twice as much. While China is building fiber optic cable 3,500 miles to link Latin America and Africa and China, while we can't even provide high-speed internet to rural America. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the stuff we should be focused on. That $5 trillion I mentioned earlier, I don't know if you were here for that. I mean, that shows you the cost of distraction, the cost of not actually holding people accountable to the promises that they make. And yeah, that's the kind of stuff I want to raise.
Another big undercurrent, and I think something that will be at the forefront when all is said and done in regards to this primary, is the same thing that drove the 2016 election with Bernie Sanders and also Donald Trump and their rise to the forefront. And that is this feeling that large corporations and political individuals fight for themselves and leave the American people kind of on the sidelines. And that has created a lot of what you're talking about before with the lack of the income stagnation. How do you address that? And how do you address the fact that millions and millions of Americans feel that the political system is so corrupt and is so run by the corporations that their stake, their voice doesn't matter, so they're willing to vote for or do anything? As a result, and I think that's one of the big driving factors in President Trump's election, in hoping to change.
No doubt about it. So, my state's a third Republican, third Democrat, third Independent. And I know lots of people that voted for Donald Trump. I meet them all the time. And I say, why did you vote for Donald Trump? And they say, because we wanted to blow it up. We wanted to blow it up. And I then say to them, congratulations, you achieved what you wanted. Now what are we going to do? Because if we want our kids to remember us well, it's not just enough for us to blow it up. There have been all kinds of moments in the country's history. I mean, we used to enslave human beings in the United States. I was talking about that earlier. Women didn't have the right to vote. Schools were segregated, as in many ways they still are today, by the way. There are all kinds of issues that we've contended with. There have been corrupt governments before, where Teddy Roosevelt had to leave a whole progressive agenda to overcome it, to bust the trust and do all of that. I mean, it's in our hands. That's the great thing about being in a democracy. I think people can get discouraged because, the cable is not the most inspiring stuff to watch at night. Social media is so corrosive. It's a fact of life, but it's incredibly corrosive. I think we're best to best when we're face to face, you know, working with each other. And That's what campaigns are all about. You know, so again, I could be accused of being naive, but I don't think there's any other way out of it except for Americans to do their duty and to say, look, we're done with this foolishness. And it wasn't just Trump. It's the stuff that led to Trump. He's a symptom of the problems that we have. We're not going to accept an idea that either that our democracy can no longer make decisions in the face of China doing what they're doing, in the face of Iran doing what they're doing, in the face of Russia doing what they're doing. And even more important than that, we're not going to accept the fact that we can't fulfill our legacy as Americans to leave the next generation in better shape. Mm-hmm. You know, there are people who commonly say these days, well, there's a worldwide market for labor. You got the Chinese, technology. No one in my state wants to accept that we are permanently reduced to a world where when the economy grows, there isn't broad distribution of that growth. They want to see that. And I think they're right to say Washington hasn't paid any attention. She had the greatest point in the world, the woman sitting over against the wall who said, why is it that Washington's priorities never seem to be our priorities? There's a reason for that. It's a special interest. It's the money in our politics. And just like Teddy Roosevelt went after it when he was running, we need somebody to go after it now.
Fowling, is this a generational change, though, where there a president is – President Obama ran on being an individual who's going to bring transformational change. Obviously, for multiple reasons, that did not take place. Donald Trump ran as an individual who's going to drain the swamp, create transformational change. The status quo is obviously strong. So does it take a president to start this process, and does this need to be something that's going to take generations to shift?
I often make that point, so you've just made it for me, and I didn't make it tonight. Here, this is not going to be about one election. These challenges that we face have been 40 years in the making, and what we need, I think, is a president who begins to drag us out of the morass that we're in right now, not just the Trump morass, but the morass of imagining that it's impossible for us to have different opinions in this country and not take those disagreements, not fashion a lazy compromise or fashion some, you know, stupid splitting the difference between two parties obsolete ideas, but take the energy of that disagreement and actually make it into something we can be proud of. That's the way we used to do it around here. And I think we need the next president to be somebody who can say that's our job as Americans, just like the founders did and the people that came after them, who also, you know, I think of as founders. If you think of ourselves, the role of a citizen with that sort of elevated standard, the standard of a founder, which is what, from the point of view of people who are going to be living here 100 years from now, we actually are, I think it throws in pretty stark relief how empty our politics is and how pathetic the partisan nature of it is. And by the way, it also suggests that maybe we shouldn't always be coming with the set in stone policy idea, but we should actually be open to hearing what voters are thinking about and what their opinions are as we run a campaign like this. And as we go,
Senator Bennett, thanks so much. We'll go to see you again soon.
No, you're wonderful to have me. Thanks. Look forward to seeing you too.
This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. Welcome back. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan, along with Paul Steinhauser. Busy weekend coming up in the Granite State once again. Tim Ryan coming and going, but Elizabeth Warren back on the campaign trail this weekend.
Yep. Hits the Seacoast area, Durham first, and then Portsmouth. And then she'll be hitting other locations, I believe, Laconia, Concord, and Dartmouth as she makes her way around the Granite State. We've talked about this. New Hampshire is a must-win state for Elizabeth Warren. Massachusetts politicians running for president have a history of winning here, and she needs to win here if she's going to have any success towards capturing the nomination. Also here this weekend, we got a couple of other people as well. John Delaney, the former congressman from Maryland. He's spending a couple days here starting on Sunday, and he'll be unveiling and really pushing his national service plan. We've also got Jay Inslee, the Washington State governor, here as well for a couple events.
I'd expect Beto O'Rourke to be here in the Granite State at some point in the near future. Just did a big tour of Iowa, and from what I understand, Pete Buttigieg will be back as well very soon to the Granite State. So it continues on, the First of the Nation presidential primary. I am Chris Ryan for Paul Steinhauser. You've been listening to On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association, as they represent the Granite State's long-term care facilities. Their mission is to see the state honor and support those who care for our most vulnerable citizens.